Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Jonathan Evans tells us about a new Statue of Liberty Museum coming to New York City. And Mario Ritter Jr. brings us this week's science report. We end our program with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, the month of December usually marks the beginning of tourism season in Sri Lanka. Visitors come to the Indian Ocean island nation to enjoy its beaches, historic places, interesting nature, and tasty food. Tourism represents about 5% of the country's $87 billion economy. But Sri Lanka's current political environment is keeping visitors away. Observers are worried about the possible economic effects. In late October, Sri Lankan President Maithripala Sirisena dismissed the country's prime minister and appointed a new government. The move came as a surprise. Mahinda Rajapaksa, who replaced Ranil Wickremesinghe as prime minister, lacks a parliamentary majority. A Sri Lankan court has prevented Rajapaksa from taking power. Violence has broken out in parliament, and the 2019 national budget has been delayed. High season for travelers to Sri Lanka usually runs from December to March. Most visitors come from Europe, India, and China. But many trips are being cancelled, especially among Europeans. The Reuters news agency received that information from someone working at the National Sri Lankan Airlines. The person asked not to be identified. The person told Reuters the crisis started just when tourists take a decision where to go. It has discouraged many of them. Chandra Mahoti is manager of the high-end Galface Hotel in the Sri Lankan capital of Colombo. She said that 20% of planned visits to the area have been cancelled. She said that normally the 200-room hotel would be filled at this time of year. But instead, the hotel has been forced to offer low-cost rates to appeal to tourists. The crisis has also affected business travel. Sanath Ukwate, president of the Hotels Association of Sri Lanka, said some companies have chosen to move their planned events to Singapore, Indonesia, and other places in Southeast Asia. Harith Pereira is president of the Sri Lanka Association of Inbound Tour Operators. He said if the current situation continues, the economic effects will be significant. More than 2.1 million people visited Sri Lanka in 2017, tourism officials say.
A microscopic organism is causing a huge clam of the Mediterranean Sea to disappear, and ocean scientists are worried. The pen-shell clam is the largest shellfish in the Mediterranean. The clam can grow to 1 meter in length. Its shell looks something like a huge feather. For hundreds of years, the clam has provided food and an unusual material called sea silk, which can be used to make a kind of cloth. The clam also cleans water by filtering out organic material from it. The European Union named the pen shell clam a protected species many years ago. The clam has been overfished and has suffered from pollution and destruction of its waters. A ban on hunting the clam also has been poorly enforced. They are harvested for food and for their unusual large shells. The pen shells can live for many years, but they take years to reach reproductive age. Now they are disappearing faster than they can be replaced. A new parasite, which first appeared in 2016, has alarmed experts. It is unclear exactly how the parasite kills the clams. Scientists say it appears to attack the pen shell's digestive system. The clam becomes unable to close its shell and can be attacked by its enemies. Maria del Mar Otero is with the International Union for Conservation of Nature. She said, in less than a year, it wiped out the pen shell population of the Spanish coast. Then waters of France, Malta, Tunisia, and Italy were affected. The suspected parasite is known only by its scientific name, Haplosporidium pinnae. Researchers say it also may be responsible for killing pen shell clams in some Greek waters and those of Turkey and Cyprus. Scientists are now racing to understand how the parasite spreads. This information is needed to protect the clam. Pantelis Katharios is a researcher at the Hellenic Center for Marine Research, or HCMR, in Greece. He said scientists are not sure of anything yet, except that the parasite is spreading quickly. Ioannis Isaris is with HCMR's Institute of Oceanography. He said tests show that the organism, which appears to be killing the clams in Greece, could be the same as the one affecting clams in Spain. This is very fresh for the scientific community, he said. We're still at the stage of recording where it has spread to. Scientists are carrying out tests in Mediterranean countries where the clams are dying. Some areas of Greece have healthy populations of the clams, but in other areas they have disappeared. They have found that only the pen shell clams are affected. A similar species, Pinna rutus, has been unharmed. And they still do not know why the parasite is so deadly to the pen shell clams. The parasites might have come from another species and for some reason jumped to the pen shell clam. It also is possible that other conditions, including pollution, climate change, or water temperature changes, could be causing the problem. Katharios said, "Normally, parasites in nature do not have any benefit from harming the host because they depend on the host." He added, "It is not clear what will happen to the pen shell clams or the microorganism affecting them. The big clams could completely disappear, taking the parasites with them." I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
A new 2,400-square-meter museum is set to open on New York State's Liberty Island next year. The museum celebrates the world-famous Statue of Liberty. The statue was a gift from the people of France to the United States. It officially opened to the public in October 1886. From 1892 to 1954, more than 12 million immigrants passed by the Statue of Liberty as their ships sailed to nearby Ellis Island. Many immigrants later traveled to Liberty Island and saw the statue up close. At the bottom are the words of poet Emma Lazarus: "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." Now, a new museum to honor Lady Liberty is on the way. Nicholas Garrison is a partner with FX Collaborative, a New York-based company that plans and designs buildings. He designed the museum.
When we first came on the island, we were moved. We saw people on their knees crying because of what this place meant. And it kind of sunk into us that this is a really special, sacred place.
About 4.5 million tourists visit Liberty Island every year. But only about 20% are able to go inside the Statue of Liberty because of limited space. The new museum will permit every visitor to know what the inside is like. The museum is expected to open in May 2019. Entering the building, visitors will experience a virtual look inside the head of Lady Liberty. They also have a chance to see a recreation of the workplace of Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi, who created the statue. Museum visitors also will see the 1,600-kilogram torch that lit up New York Harbor for nearly 100 years. It was replaced in 1985. On top of the Statue of Liberty Museum, visitors can have a good look at New York's Lower Manhattan area. Nicholas Garrison says the museum tries to be inspirational unto itself as its own object, while being respectful to the buildings that are here. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but, as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams, a man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton, kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. But they were not. One was a Secretary of State who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a Secretary of the Treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a Secretary of War who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as commander-in-chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Furling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas, and he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They're the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented. And the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Furling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Furling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington. And called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for more stories and information from around the world. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Thompson.